Well, the organizers asked me to say something about Gary in whatever time that Phil left out of the 10 minutes he had. And Phil, you know, can go on, right? So I thought I would try to think of one word that would characterize Gary. And that word is clear. Clear in his direction, clear in his intuition, clear in argument, clear in explanation, clear on what the department should do, clear on what we should do in the grant. And this, I think, arises from a remarkable combination that you don't find every day of mathematical insight, physical intuition, and scientific vision at the same time. There are many people that have one or the other or more, but very few that have three. And Gary's vision is broad, right? He works on the great questions of the day, which you'll be familiar with, but it's always realized in concrete detail, right? That it's vision realized in the details. And that's also unusual for somebody whose mathematical strengths are like his are. And it's precisely because of that, right? Because of this vision, I think that he sees things in a clear and organized fashion. On a more personal level, I can say Gary has always been helpful in scientific questions. You make use of this clarity by going to talk to him, and he will often sort you out how to raise indices, how to lower indices, that sort of sort of thing. And so I'd encourage you, right, if you have a problem, to go talk to him. But I have to also issue one word of warning about that. Just because he's not yelling at you doesn't mean that he agrees with you. There are people which you can tell the difference. So, of course, all these characteristics have led to great achievements in gravitational physics and in the related areas of string theory. But there's certainly no need for me to go into that. That's what the entire session is about. And so, therefore, I'd like to call on the first speaker, Jim Eisenberg, to tell us about On Strong Cosmic Censorship.
Somebody just took a bit of paper. Jim, did you take a piece of paper from there?
Oh, maybe I did.
No, no. There it is. Oh. Yeah, many of you know I like to wear a hat, so I'm not sure which one to wear. So. Yeah, well, this is a year for major anniversaries. It's, of course, the 100th anniversary of general relativity, the 50th anniversary of the discovery of cosmic microwave background, the 60th anniversary of Gary's birth. As well, it's the 40th anniversary within an error bar of a year from my meeting Gary. Gary was finishing up at Princeton, and he was deciding where to go to grad school. At the time, the major places to study general relativity were Princeton, Caltech, Texas, Syracuse, Chicago, and Maryland. I was in my second year at Maryland, and it was my job as a fellow Princetonian to convince Gary to go there as well. I tried, and I tried, but I think his seeing my office filled with IBM...
You have two microphones.
Two microphones. Seeing my office filled with IBM computer cards didn't help at all. So Gary didn't become a grad school colleague, but he did become a really good friend. I greatly value his willingness over the years to explain what's really going on in string theory, and to convince me that I shouldn't hate the LA Lakers, which is not an issue at all this year. But much more, I greatly value my friendship with Gary, Corinne, and their family over these many years, almost half a life for general relativity. So there's one more anniversary worth noting. Let's see if this goes on. 50 years ago, when Gary was 10, I don't know if you remember this, Roger Penrose wrote the first of the papers describing his new results on the occurrence of singularities in solutions of Einstein's equations. Should the light go off? Can you see that? So at the time there was a great debate about singularities. This was in the 1960s. Most of the known solutions of Einstein's equations had a singularity of the sort that the curvature was blowing up. And the question was this an artifact of the symmetry that of these solutions? Just about all of them had symmetry. In fact, I think all of them did. Or was it really a feature of generic solutions? And this, of course, if one thinks of general relativity as governing the physics of the universe, was relevant in the sense that should this argue for or against a Big Bang and a Big Crunch, or should one expect that isolated concentrations of stuff would collapse gravitationally to whatever. So in the 60s, I think the first paper was 1965 by Penrose, but eventually a number of other papers, including by Bob Geroch. There were so-called Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems, which say that if a space-time satisfies some sort of a energy condition, satisfies a so-called, I never like the expression here, the generic curvature condition, and also has a Cauchy surface, that is, it can be generated from initial data on some hypersurface, which is either compact or asymptotically Euclidean with a trapped surface, then the space-time is singular. But it's singular in a particular sense, as singular in the sense that causal geodesics would be incomplete. So that wasn't, it was very, very interesting, but the issue is I'm using CGI for causal geodesic incompleteness, what is that telling us? It's of course telling us that the clock stopped, and that's not very good, but is it telling us that the curvature blows up, or is it telling us anything about black hole formation, or what is it telling us? And in thinking about this, it's useful to think a little bit about some of the solutions known at the time. I'm just picking a couple here. The Kasner solution. What happens in Kasner? Of course, you could start with initial data here, and what happens is the tidal forces, the curvature blows up as you approach a singularity. But in another one, well known at the time, what's now known as the Taub-Nut solution. So you start at a Cauchy surface, everything's fine, but then the light cones start tipping, and eventually it becomes causally geodesically incomplete. However, the curvature is bounded. What's happening is that then you get closed time-like lines, there's different evolutions of the same data, and that's something different. So the theorems are telling us that we have causal geodesic incompleteness, but what is it really telling us is happening? Other solutions to think about is, if you look at the Tolman, Oppenheimer, Volkoff, Schwarzschild solution, there, of course, you have a curvature singularity coming, and it's covered up by an event horizon, so one has a black hole. And I didn't draw a picture of A greater than M curve, but in this case, one has a curvature singularity, but it's not covered up by an event horizon, and so so these solutions were known, and so the singularity theorems are telling us that that generically, in some sense, it would be causally geodesically incomplete, but what's really happening? Not really understood. So lots and lots of debate about this, but it's actually hard to find where these statements first appear in print. I've told that a number of conferences, maybe Jim can tell us where, but Penrose started discussing a couple of conjectures. One has come to be called the strong cosmic censorship conjecture, and an intuitive version of this is that if you have a globally hyperbolic spacetime, one that can be generated completely causally from initial data on a hypersurface, globally hyperbolic solution of Einstein's equations, that it generically cannot be extended past the Cauchy horizon. So that funny behavior in Taub-Nut would be just a relic of a very small number of solutions. So if this were true, then causal geodesic incompleteness would generically be marked by curvature blowups. That's one of the conjectures that I think I first saw that in print in the late 60s. And then another one, the weak cosmic censorship. The intuitive version is if you have a generic asymptotically flat space-time solution of Einstein's equations, the curvature is bounded outside of any event horizon. So any singularities in the sense of curvature blow-up would occur inside a black hole. So these were the conjectures. And it's nice to think back, especially for something I'll talk about a little bit later, what his motivations for these things were. For strong cosmic censorship, in a sense, it was the what I've seen referred to as the blue shift instability of Cauchy horizons. So here's a Penrose diagram of the Kerr solution, squared minus, you know, past infinity, future infinity. Here's the event horizon, and here's a Cauchy horizon. The singularity is well covered up here. And the idea is if there's little bits of stuff here, which are, you know, sort of a perturbation of Kerr, a real deformation of Kerr, that as it goes past the event horizon towards the Cauchy horizon, it'll blue shift, and eventually essentially disrupt the Cauchy horizon. So the idea is that the Cauchy horizon should be a very unstable feature, and that's, in a sense, the motivation for strong cosmic censorship. The motivation for weak cosmic censorship, as far as I can tell, is he just didn't like naked singularities. So the big issue is, are these things true, strong cosmic censorship and weak cosmic censorship? I'm going to focus entirely on strong cosmic censorship and leave weak cosmic censorship to others. Before going into evidence for and against, a couple of comments. First of all, in actually trying to make concrete sense of these things, I think it's fair to be reminded that strong cosmic censorship is a mathematics question, not a physics question. So what one is asking is the occurrence of Cauchy horizons, the non-occurrence of curvature blowups or naked singularities, is that, I mean, that's a physics question, but these things are really about what's happening with generic subsets of all solutions. So you look at the set of all solutions, and I mean, if you find millions and millions of solutions which have Cauchy horizons, and in fact, Vince Moncrief found infinite dimensional families of these things, so there's lots of them, but that doesn't say that strong cosmic censorship is right or wrong. It's really about generic. So if one is going to actually have a statement of strong cosmic censorship, you have to make sense of all these things. And so, yeah, generic is very crucial to the statement of either of them. I should also mention that there's, even though one is called strong cosmic censorship and the other weak cosmic censorship, there's no implication between them. One could be true and the other not true. Okay, so again, I want to focus on strong cosmic censorship, but rather than that, is it really true? I want to instead think about these issues. Is there a strong cosmic censorship inspired theorem? I mean, to actually say this is absolutely strong cosmic censorship, right or wrong, that may be a fool's game. I think better to think of other theorems you can prove which are inspired and which are inspired by the ideas, and correspondingly, ideas inspired by strong cosmic censorship which are counter to this. Again, the short answer is one doesn't have either. On the other hand, there's been, in recent years, a lot of interesting progress in both directions. So what I'm going to talk about in the first, probably two-thirds of the talk, is model strong cosmic censorships, model strong cosmic censorship theorems. By that I mean theorems that encapsulate the idea of strong cosmic censorship in reduced families of spacetimes. And many of these involve the AVTD, asymptotically velocity term dominated BKL scenario. I'll talk about that, and then I'll talk about some recent model counter strong cosmic censorship theorems, which involve so-called weak null singularities. So what I mean by these model theorems again is more specifically this. So we choose a restricted family of spacetimes defined by isometry. The simplest ones would be the locally homogeneous spacetimes where the Einstein equations reduce to ODEs, ordinary differential equations, three-dimensional isometry. Then there are the Gaudi solutions, two-dimensional isometry with an extra condition, the T2 symmetric solutions, the U1 symmetric. So in all of these, we're going down in isometry, becoming more and more general. And what one would like to do is have a concrete, specific statement of strong cosmic censorship in, I think it's getting weaker. But a concrete statement of strong cosmic censorship within this class and argue that that the occurrence of kosher horizons is a set of measure zero, for example. So I state here one of the earlier model versions of these things, a theorem due to Piotr Kreschel and Moncrief and me, which I think gives a very concrete version of how to do this. Unfortunately, I mean, the spacetimes are very, very simple, so it's not surprising it hasn't generalized as much as we'd like. But so let me state it here as, so we take I'll let script P be the space of initial data for the so-called polarized Gaudi spacetimes. And the statement is, and that space of initial data has a well-defined topology, so one can define what it means to be a set of measure zero, and what one can show is that for all but a set of measure zero of this initial data, the maximal space-time development has a singularity in the sense with the curvature blowing up, and so Cauchy horizons would not occur. This, by the way, is an initial value problem formulation of strong cosmic censorship, which doesn't absolutely have to be the way to go, but and I think it's notable that one of the people who thought about that initially was Doug Erdley, who was a UCSB guy. I guess he's still here. So these model strong cosmic censorship theorems, they don't prove anything about the full theorem. What they do, however, is give us practice in rigorously formulating the theorem and practice in proving these things. And in principle, and this has always been the idea, you march down the symmetry ladder. You go from one, you know, remove symmetry and try to prove the same thing. And so I have here a table of what one knows about these sorts of things, and I'll go through this a little bit in the next 5-10 minutes of my talk. But let me just say what this table is giving us. So here's a family. We're starting with the locally homogeneous. Those are the simplest solutions. Polarized Gaudi, polarized T2 symmetric. Polarized, by the way, just means that the metric on the orbits of the isometry group are diagonal. So you're losing sort of one of the 2 degrees of freedom of gravitation. So there's the polarized T2 symmetric, polarized U1 symmetric, the U1 symmetric. Then there's a general vacuum. And there's also a curious collection of solutions, the general solution, no isometries with stiff fluid or certain scalar fields. And then there's also a strange category of 11 dimensions. I don't know what 11 dimensions has to do with anything, but at any rate, it does come up here. So I'm listing here just the isometry dimensions. And the Y's here all mean in these classes one has a model strong cosmic censorship theorem, a rigorous theorem. As I said, I mentioned that earliest one. The proof there isn't, this one. But the proof here is quite intricate and very, very interesting, relatively recent. So at any rate, they only go down as far as the Gaudi solutions. Then I list here AVTD. Again, I'll explain what that means in a few minutes, but what I'm stating here is those, again, this thing, is there another laser pointer? This one I don't think you can see at all. Okay. So one has, so the yeses, again, the y's again mean that there's good evidence for asymptotically velocity term dominated behavior. N's mean that one in that first category, that's saying that one has actually proven that AVTD behavior is generic. The next column, AVTD evidence, is that there's strong reason for believing that this is true. And finally, in the last category, there's mixed master stuff, and I'll talk some about that. So why is one interested in this in talking about strong cosmic censorship? So let me say something about what AVTD behavior is and the role it plays in proving strong cosmic censorship. All those cases where we have an SCC, model SCC theorem, it's played a crucial role. So a way to think about AVTD behavior is to think about the Hamiltonian for general relativity in terms of a kinetic term, which I'm calling pi, and a potential term, which I'll call v. And a definition for these things is that a particular space-time is AVTD if you know where the singularity is, and as you approach the singularity, the potential part is dominated by the kinetic part. So I have these pictures here. Think of these, that one on the left there with the blue siding. Think of that as a solution going towards a singularity up at the top there. P P1 and P2 are just different observers, and if you look at the ratio of V versus V over pi, you can see that it's very irregular, but it's getting very smaller and smaller, and eventually the potential part goes away, and it turns out then you can approximate very accurately the evolution of that solution by the solution of the VTD equations, which is just get rid of all the spatial derivatives in the Einstein equations. That's what AVTD behavior is, and I like to think of each observer has his or her own private Kasner as they're going towards a singularity, which may or may not be comforting as you're headed towards disaster. But so that's what AVTD behavior in a particular solution is, and one says that the family is AVTD if the generic solution has that behavior. So how is it useful in proving a model strong cosmic censorship theorem? Well, the idea is fairly simple, that to study the behavior of the curvature for these special solutions, the VTD solutions, the asymptotic solutions, is very easy. And it's in those cases, the cases where it's been proven, you can look at that and you can show that curvature blow-up is generic. And then if you set up a nice isomorphism between, I mean, so one has the solutions approaching that, and then if one can show rigorously that the topology is carried across that isomorphism, then one can show that the curvature, great, then one can show that the curvature of the solutions you're actually interested in is blowing up generically. So that's a way to use the AVTD behavior. So a crucial step in proving these model SCC theorems has been to establish AVTD behavior. And in all those cases, yeah, that's been important. Well, yeah, I mean, well, in the simple cases, the polarized Gaudi, for example, you can see that it's blowing up exponentially. It's blowing up very fast. In the Gaudi, it's a little harder to see because the thing that made that fairly difficult and a very nice mathematical result is the so-called the spiky behavior, and they make it difficult to see exactly the rate that this is happening. But it's fairly clear though that it's happening at a rate that there's absolutely no extensions that you're going to see. Of course, that becomes a big issue in these counter theorems that I'm going to talk about towards the end. These weak null singularities. So a lot of the work in this area has been to find evidence for AVTD behavior in families of solutions. So there are four levels of doing this. For some of them, there's actually been proofs that the generic solution is in the family is AVTD, and that's in the polarized Gaudi, the Gaudi solutions, again, the very nice work of Ringstrom of about five years ago. So that's the strongest AVTD evidence that can be had, and it's sort of the gold standard to aim for. The next is to prove that open sets of solutions in the family are AVTD. So here there's some very nice, very recent work by Rodniansky and Speck in looking at these curious general solutions, no isometries at all, which have either stiff fluid or certain scalar field, coupled to Einstein. And so in a sense, what they're really looking at is they're proving a stability of AVTD behavior around the Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker solutions. So this is the strongest. This is also fairly strong. This is not as strong, but it's what we have in many cases. And I think it's fair to say that whenever this has been proven, there've never been any cases where one proves that there's lots of solutions which are AVTD and it's not generically AVTD. So here, the analysis that's used is something that I call the asymptotic initial value problem. So using so-called Fuchsian analyses of the Einstein equations in these isometry classes. So what one is doing is essentially looking for initial data, if you will, at the singularity. And character. So to do that, of course, there is not, you don't have an initial value problem like that, but what one can do is look at that asymptotic data and argue that taking initial data sets, which you're approaching there, will be, again, you'll have that nice isomorphism between the behavior of this asymptotic data, which essentially amounts to the degrees of freedom that of that G hat that I talked about, and the data on a real Cauchy surface. And there are two levels of this. The first few results were in the analytic category, so that's where you're working with solutions where, you know, the Taylor series exist and converge. But many mathematicians sneer at analytic stuff. Recently, there's been some work on finding the same results for smooth. So what does one show here? What one shows is one finds infinite dimensional families of solutions in the class, which are AVTD. One isn't proving that it's an open set. One isn't proving that it's open and dense in any sense, but one sees lots and lots of solutions. And this has been shown for the polarized T2 symmetric, polarized U1. Actually, there are half-polarized versions of these, and they also have this AVTD behavior and these funny general solutions in 11 dimensions. Anybody that wants to ask about that, I can say a little bit about that later. And I guess, also it's also true in that what happened? Okay, there. Okay, yeah. Okay, so there are this class of showing AVTD, and finally there's observation of numerical simulations that was key to actually getting people interested in this. I think it's fair to say that's really what got people to think about AVTD behavior and the BKL business again. I mean, so this during that great debate about the genericity of singularities and solutions of Einstein's equations in the 60s, there was the work of Kolotnikov and Lifshitz, and they were arguing that singularities were not generic in any sense, and they set up this formalism, which was later generalized with Belinsky, called the BKL. A lot of people thought this was, to put it mildly, didn't make a lot of sense, particularly after the singularity theorems came out, and it was pretty much ignored. But then there was some very nice numerical stuff done, I think largely by Beverly Berger and Vince Moncrief in the 80s, I believe, or 80s or early 90s, which started seeing in these families of solutions this kind of behavior, this AVTD behavior in particular. So this was first seen. So I'm mentioning here for Gaudi, this was the first set of solutions really studied this way. Then after that, this asymptotic initial value problem study using Fuchsian techniques was carried out for these same solutions, first analytic, then smooth, then the global analysis by Ringstrom, and more global analysis to prove this beautiful model strong cosmic censorship theorem for Gaudi. Does one expect generic solutions to be AVTD? Again, in the early 60s, Kolotnikov and Lifshitz might have said yes, but numerical simulations absolutely indicate no. A lot of people, when AVTD was, realized it wasn't going to be generic, people started talking about Mixmaster. And Mixmaster is sort of an episodic version of AVTD. It looks like it's going to be AVTD, then you have these so-called bounces or eruptions or whatever you want to call them, then it looks like AVTD again, bounces again. And actually, in the AVTD solutions, you generally see these bounces, but they stop. In the Mixmaster, they don't. So people started thinking lots about these. There are lots of numerical solutions and the like. The only problem with this is, for one, it's been very difficult to prove, in fact, except for the actual homogeneous cosmologies themselves, the type 9, the mix where the name originally came from, no family of solutions has ever been proven to be generic Mixmaster. And it's also not totally clear how one would use that to prove strong cosmic censorship. So there's still a lot of work being done on this, but it's mostly question marks, I think. So there's lots of this work on the model strong cosmic censorship theorem up to a limited class of solutions. Although again, I mentioned there's those general solutions with no isometries, but have certain sources where one might expect that one will be able to prove strong cosmic censorship using AVTD, and then there's also those 11-dimensional things. Let me talk a little bit about the counter-SCC theorems. So the goal here is to show that the existence of Cauchyisms in solutions is stable in the sense of, you know, countering again that the lack of these would be generic. If one can prove that Cauchyisms are stable in all solutions, one would have a counter strong cosmic censorship theorem and if you do this in a family of solutions, it would be a model counter SEC theorem. So no such results are known unless one generalizes Cauchy-Ries into what's called a weak null singularity. And these are these things that at least I first became aware of from the work of de Fermos 10 or 15 years ago. And the what they found there is, so he was in particular looking at the Cauchy-Ries inside Ries and Nordstrom originally. And so the question was, well, he was actually, you know, he was thinking about that blue shift effect. Would perturbations get rid of it? And he looked at perturbations, and he found that you could do C0 extension, just so you could extend the metric. He found lots of solutions where you could extend the metric, but you couldn't extend the connections, you couldn't extend the curvature. So those have come to be called weak null singularities. So what's happened on these, again, there was that original stuff by de Fermos, and then very recently there's been some beautiful work by Jonathan Luke, along with de Fermos and some others, showing that this that the occurrence of these things may very well be at least a stable feature. So one, so now the issue then becomes is this really, oh yeah, so I'm giving where you see weak null singularities. So this is a spherically symmetric case, perhaps a general case, and I mentioned also that Kip Thorne has said that Gargantua has a weak null singularity inside it. And if you're wondering how the astronauts made it through, that's what it is. But anyway, yeah. So is this really a counter-strong cosmic censorship theorem? If you have extensions in this funny way, have you proven a counter-strong cosmic censorship theorem? De Fermos claims yes, and he claims that with this work, if they can just prove the stability of Kerr exterior, which is very, very hard, at least mathematicians believe that. I'm not sure if physicists believe it. But anyway, he claims that if one finishes proving that, there's a huge amount of work on it, then one would have a counter-strong cosmic censorship, strong counter-SEC theorem. But there's still this issue of, is a weak extension really enough? But, I mean, that's all, you know, someone says, is strong cosmic censorship true? And I think it's not fair to just have that as a single question. What you can do is get a number of results which are motivated by it, and there have been some nice results that I've mentioned in this talk in both directions. And even if one were to prove what these things are aiming for and also prove these, that wouldn't necessarily be a contradiction, because in a sense one has different sorts of conjectures, different sorts of explicit conjectures and perhaps explicit theorems which would be proven, which one of them is against the spirit of strong cosmic censorship and the other is for it, but that's not necessarily a contradiction, at least as this is done. So lots to do. I think there's still a lot of mathematical work going on this. I think people have been discouraged by what's happened with Mixmaster. People thought one would be, and there are these billiard programs, etc., but it's not clear that those are really headed anywhere in proving that that Mixmaster can be a good tool. But lots of things going on in this area, and I think it'll be exciting to watch it as time goes on for Gary's 100th birthday in 40 years. Maybe that's when we'll finally have a resolution of this to some extent. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, for an amazingly comprehensive talk in a very short time. We have 15 minutes for discussions and questions, and I guess Gary gets to make the first thing. Gary, can you use the microphone so everybody can hear you? And that's in general true. If you can get up here, right, use the microphone so everybody can hear. Maybe it's not on.
Is it on?
Yeah. Okay. If not, speak loudly, please.
So I know some reasons why 11 dimensions is special, but I'm wondering why it's special for you.
This is my work. This is the work of Hano and I think Damour and, yeah, a number of people. Yeah, so what they found is that, if you look at ABTD, behavior and why, mixed master, you can look in terms of those potentials. And in three dimensions,
let me see, maybe there's a better way to think about it.
Anyway, yeah, this velocity-dominated behavior is essentially Kasner-type behavior. And so you see in three dimensions you have the conditions, that the norm of k squared and the sum of these things is of the
the velocities is equal to one. And if you put, so for example, so that makes things very rigid. And so in general solutions of Einstein's equations, those conditions aren't going to hold, and so you're going to have these episodic bounces. But if you put in the stiff fluid, that, for example, can get rid of that strong restriction, and then you can see it happening. Also, if you go up in higher dimensions. Why it happens in 11 seems to be the first dimension they find it in, I don't really know. Anyway, it's all about seeing whether the approach of the solutions to Kasner is avoided by these restrictions on what the Kasner conditions are, which is a very dimension-dependent thing. So I don't think that, yeah, that's probably not a good explanation of it. And certainly I'm not explaining 11 dimensions at all, but that's it's just as you're going up in dimensions, these restrictions on whether you're going to get approaching to Kasner or having to approach something more general like mixmaster change from as you go up in dimensions, or by adding, going away from vacuum and going to solutions with non-vacuum solutions.
Loud or microphone, please.
The microphone. So, I mean, you talked about 11 dimensions, but there's also stuff going on in 5 dimensions.
Yeah, thank you. So.
It was the hat.
Right. So, 5-dimensional black strings are unstable, and many years ago, Gary pointed out that if a 5-dimensional black string pinches off into black holes, that would create a naked singularity. And we don't have any mathematical results, but we have some beautiful numerical results due to Lehner and Pretorius that shows that the 5-dimensional string does pinch off. So why aren't we going around saying that, well, you know, cosmic censorship is violated in 5 dimensions?
So is that a result relative to strong cosmic censorship or weak cosmic censorship?
I believe both.
Really?
Yeah.
So what would be, so the statement there would be you would find an open set which can be, of solutions which can be extended, from initial data could be extended across the Cauchy-Riesz and then the space-time. That would be, so you're arguing that there would be a counter strong cosmic censorship theorem in that sense, in 5 dimensions with, so what
right,
would
well, so far there's just numerical evidence, but
no,
it's
no,
pretty
well,
good numerical evidence.
Numerical evidence tells you what to look for to try to prove.
Yeah.
So I think what one wants to do then, from the numerical evidence, is then state what you would try to show. Show stability of some particular behavior, or show, again, you know, I'm putting on my mathematician hat or something here, but, you know, anyway, you know, one wants to have, and I'm not criticizing this at all, because, again, the numerical stuff, I think, beautifully tells you what to look to show, but one wants to still go from there and say, okay, we have this class of space-times, we want to show that there's an open set of initial data which can be extended across the Cauchy horizon. So one thinks there are cases there, is that so one would have a conjecture there?
The numerical simulations don't go up to the Cauchy horizon because they stop when a singularity forms.
Okay.
But certainly as a violation of weak cosmic censorship, it looks clear, and
yeah.
I would guess strong cosmic censorship as well.
Yeah. So, okay, we'll talk about that later. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Other questions, comments? Where? Abe.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, Jim told us about the great qualities of Gary, which are basically, you know, his great strength in physics and great strength in mathematics and clarity, which, you know. So, your talk was mainly motivated by mathematics, but taking, you know, this is Gary's first. I would like to understand the interface between this work, which is going on for many, many, many years, and possible physics. So let me be provocative, just to have the discussion here. So let me just say that, well, these singularity theorems are really something that happens in a domain where we all know general relativity is not applicable. So if I took electromagnetism and just took a hydrogen atom, I would just look at it classically, I would find that it will radiate, and then slowly it would fall into the electron would fall into the proton, right? I mean, and so supposing there was a big program which actually went and said, how does it exactly happen in classical electrodynamics? Take an electron, take the radiation reaction, take everything, and see how it radiates and goes down. I think most people in physics part would say you're wasting your time, right? In a sense, I'm being provocative. So you're wasting your time because you know that's where quantum mechanics comes in, and we should really analyze it using quantum mechanics, and there is no singularity. So one possibility could be that maybe these singularity theorems are telling us what we should do to go beyond.
Yeah, let me try two answers. The first one is the coward's answer that I'm paid by a math department, so I do math and, you know, but anyway, that's not fair. Another answer might be, a difference there is I think one understands to some extent what's going on with the electromagnetic case you're talking about. You're talking about quantum mechanics. I think in the gravity case one doesn't understand, and I still like to believe in these cases where one doesn't really understand quantum gravity, for example, that it's useful to still see what the classical stuff is telling us. So the classical theorem, the classical theory is obviously, I agree, of course, I was born a physicist. I know that that these things are not going to make any sense when you get arbitrarily close to the singularity. But you know, it's also this issue when one looks at these quantum field theories, and there's this issue: is it well posed? You take a classical theory, you go the quantum theory. Is the well posedness of the classical theory, which has to do with just technical mathematical thing, is that relevant for the for understanding the full theory? And I'd still like to argue that until we understand much better that regime that we're dealing with, perhaps without knowing what's going on, until we understand that much better, these things can be helpful.
My question is really that. I mean, what can we learn? So the question is that, for example, I mean, you told us about ATVD and so on. So supposing, in fact, there was actually some theorems within some candidate quantum theory, in loop quantum cosmology, for example, we have such thing, which would say that all the Bianchi models, and certainly the Kasner universe, the singularity is actually resolved. Then can we make some argument? Can we sort of then say that, well, since generic behavior is supposed to be like what Kasner says, like the Kasner at each point, and therefore, in fact, this is going in that direction. What can we take from these mathematics results for quantum gravity?
I agree. That's right. That's a very good question. One should really understand what the implications would be. Because again, arbitrarily close to the singularity, something is going to take over. But still, I mean, a lot of these results are what kind of behavior you're seeing close to the singularity. You can argue how close it is, whether it's, purely in the quantum regime. But I guess I'd like, I think what you're asking is a very good point. What can one learn from understanding whether generically you have curvature blowups or whether you have and I'm simplifying things a little bit. There are also other things that could happen besides curvature blowup and Cauchy horizon. But understanding that, for what the classical solutions are aiming for, what could that tell us about what to look for in the quantum regime, if you will? Yeah, so very good point. But again, these theorems are stated strictly as mathematical theorems for the classical theory of relativity. And again, what happens generically? What does that have to do with our particular universe? That's a very different issue. But your point is good. One should think about how these things are, what they're telling us about this regime that we don't understand at all yet.
Okay, thank you. We still have time for a 2-minute comment.
Any?
Important question. I'd like to ask it in a slightly different way. And that is, my sense is when the singularities were first discovered in general relativity, they were kind of an embarrassment. Wheeler referred to them as the greatest crisis of all time. And then people were somewhat relieved that they could be hidden behind an event horizon, and that is where the idea of cosmic censorship came in. And that strikes me as very strange because, of course, all the laws of physics should ultimately break down at some point and be replaced by new and better ones.
Right.
So, for example, in the example that Abe gave, how annoying it would have been, when the electron falling into the proton, if we studied that classically, how annoying it, the fact that we could see that happening, that's a kind of singular process, that resolving that led to the Bohr atom, and that led us beyond classical, that was a great thing that we could see the breakdown of electrodynamics. In contrast, it's extremely annoying that we can't see the singularities that that want to happen in general relativity, and it's a
if something like we cosmic
if
censorship
cosmic is. Censorship is true. Now, whether or not cosmic censorship, so it's good if we can see the laws of physics break down, and there's no reason we shouldn't be able to see that happen. So I don't know what those people were thinking that this ought to happen back in the 60s. From my point of view, it's not so much, it's clear that even if there are some subtle counterexamples to cosmic censorship, it's almost true, or it's true, it's often true.
Oh, yeah.
Why is it often true?
Yeah, no, very good point.
Why should it be so close to being true?
Yeah.
It's just irritating for us. And I can't think of any good conceptual reason why it should be true. So let me, that's my question. Why is it almost true?
So I direct that to Jim, who was around then.
It's not true that I had important conversations with Einstein on singularities.
But Penrose.
I don't know. Thank you.
There's no way. Yeah, there are things one needs to think about, of course. This is the story with the strictly classical theory, and what it tells you, I can't say. I'm still thinking of it as an interesting problem to pursue.
Thanks, Jim. Let's thank the speaker again.